Rome Strikes Back. It was on the 6th of July, 1553, that the 16-year-old King Edward VI died, a disaster which sent shivers of alarm through the hearts of all who longed for the full reformation of the Church in England. Edward himself had realized what was waiting in the wings. Ready and eager to take his place, he knew only too well what the nature of the danger was, even the calamity which would overtake the godly following his death, and the menacing form it would take. His last prayer expressed it very clearly, when he said, "O Lord God, defend this realm from papistry, and maintain thy true religion." Edward also knew who would be responsible for it. He not only knew what the danger was, he knew from whence it came. He had taken steps to avert it months, even years before. In 1550, he had written to his papist sister, the Lady Mary, who was his lawful successor, appealing to her to give up her participation in the Mass. But she refused, point blank. In point of fact, she had openly and defiantly made a public spectacle of her continued attendance at the abomination. A year later, the king invited the Lady Mary to court, and spoke to her personally and directly on the matter. Nevertheless, she remained adamant, even though the king warned her that since she was a subject of the crown, she was duty-bound to obey him. You see, he tried the Constantine ploy on her, but to little effect, for Mary did not lack influential friends, especially on the continent. Edward discovered that two can play the Constantine game. Charles, the Holy Roman Emperor, even threatened war against England if Mary was not allowed to continue her attendance at the Mass. Cranmer and Ridley then urged the king to tolerate Mary's rebellion. But Edward was loath to agree, stoutly pressing scriptural arguments upon his advisers. Nonetheless, they resisted the young king's objections, got their way with him, and Mary was allowed to go on in her papist observances. So it was that, as Edward approached the time of his death, he was well aware of the threat to the newly reformed Church of England. A resurgent and aggressive Romanism would be established when Mary came to power. Hence his final prayer. As Edward's time drew near, a foolish scheme was hatched to try to forestall the inevitable accession of Mary, and thus avert the disaster which was bound to follow. Upon the king's death, the unwise plan was duly acted out. Even Archbishop Cranmer fell in with the mad venture, though with some reluctance on his part, it must be said. The mistaken notion had been devised by some who, out of personal and political motives, tried to divert the succession to the Lady Jane Grey. The brief farce proved very costly. And the folly backfired. Indeed, it served to increase the popularity of the enemies of the Reformation. It also made the reformers themselves unpopular with the people, who saw through the misguided and politically motivated effort to protect the work of God. It was a grievous mistake. It always is a mistake, and worse, it is sinful disobedience, to try to fight God's battles with the secular arm. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal. Naturally, Satan uses political weapons, and especially the sword against the Church. But the Church must remember the word of the Lord, that it is not by might nor by power that God's cause is advanced in the world. Political manipulation is not a tool for believers to make use of in the cause of God. We shall find, however, that it was employed many times during the years this book deals with, and always with disastrous results. There have been several examples of it already. Miserable and misused, poor Lady Jane Grey reigned for a mere 10 days. For her pains, she was imprisoned in the Tower, and then lost her head upon the block at the stroke of an axe. Following this stupid debacle, Edward's elder sister, the Lady Mary, was duly and lawfully proclaimed Queen of England in 1553. Overnight, by this one act, England became a very different country. She now had a different monarch on the throne, and a monarch who was more different to King Edward it would be hard to imagine. As I noted earlier, in some years before, under King Henry, the Church of England had thrown off the yoke of the papacy, but had retained the trappings of popery, in that the king had become his own pope in England. But under his son Edward, the reforms had now advanced to the extent that much of the fabric of popery had been demolished, and the Church of England had become largely Protestant. Much good work had been done in Edward's reign. The Latin services had been abolished. Images had been removed from places of worship. Some superstitious practices and customs had been abandoned. The Bible had been brought back to its rightful position. But although much had been accomplished, much more remained to be done to bring about the full reformation of the state church and the restoration of the pattern of the New Testament. Hooper and others had seen the dangers of a partial, incomplete reformation, and had given clear and trenchant warnings about it. We know that Hooper, in particular, had spoken up, stood against unbiblical religion, and had even been imprisoned for his obstinacy. Nevertheless, nests of popery had been allowed to remain in the national church, and with Mary now on the throne, the rooks were about to return, as Calvin had warned. Rome was about to strike back. Even the incomplete and infant reforms in the Church of England were about to be abolished, as the English Reformation underwent a massive reversal. Popery was to be re-established. The Reformation was to be snuffed out. Mary had been a staunch and rigid papist right from her earliest days, and on her accession to the throne of England, she quickly demonstrated that she was the true daughter of her father Henry VIII. Almost the first thing she did after becoming queen was to send to Rome for the dispatch of the papal legate. When Cardinal Pole arrived in England, the queen, Parliament, and all the religious authorities knelt before him in order to receive his, that is, papal, absolution for the heresy and schism, so-called, which had taken place in England under Henry and Edward. England was penitent. The Pope's envoy welcomed the so-called prodigal back into the fold of the one true and Catholic Church, and incited the people to persecute the heretics. But losing no time, Mary did not wait until the legate arrived before putting her plans into effect, nor indeed until Parliament assembled to legalize her actions. Oh no. She started on her Romanizing work at once. Engaging in deceit, she even had the audacity, the gall, to lie to the people of England and assure them that she meant graciously not to compel or strain other people's consciences otherwise than God shall put in their hearts a persuasion of the truth. Such words were cheap, but her savage actions spoke louder and longer. Ask those many godly women who were made widows through her barbaric tortures. Ask the orphans who saw their parents butchered. Ask the children who themselves were put to the flames. Ask them about the worth of Queen Mary's promise, graciously not to compel or strain them to give up the gospel and go back to popery. Listen to them. I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren, who would be killed as they were, was completed. Mary was a rabid zealot for the Roman Church, for the paraphernalia of popery, and all the corruptions and superstitions of that depraved religion. She was indeed a very papist of papists. Under her rule, Edward's reforms were quickly abolished. All the good that had been attempted was stopped and reversed. Romanism was restored, and with a vengeance. Cranmer was immediately detained on house arrest. Others, including Hooper, were imprisoned even before the law granted Mary permission. In October 1553, all the acts of reform under Edward were repealed. But even before Parliament could meet to ratify the changes, the abomination of the Mass was brought back into the Church of England, and the use of images and ornaments restored. Under Mary's tyranny, those papists who had been removed from office in Edward's reign were reinstated to bishoprics and the highest political positions. Romanists were installed in key places of influence throughout the land. The English service was abolished and Latin restored. The writings of the continental reformers, besides those of Tyndale, Hooper, and other Englishmen of the same ilk, were proscribed. Foreign papists were encouraged to come to England, whereas the foreign reformers, resident in the country, and who previously had been welcomed, now were banished. Within 2 years of these changes, Rome was once again firmly established in England as the state religion. But this was not enough for Rome. Oh no. The papacy, through Queen Mary, stood ready to vent her spleen on the friends of the Reformation. A price was to be exacted for the break with Rome under Henry and Edward. The battle for the church was about to be waged in blood and flame. The first to be put to the stake was John Rogers. He had done sterling work in the cause of Christ, in that he had assisted Tyndale and Coverdale in the production of the English Bible, commonly known as Matthew's Bible. His enemies referred to him as Rogers, alias Matthew. The treatment meted out to Rogers was cruel in the extreme. His wife was not allowed to see him in prison, and his final glimpse of her and his 10 children was as he passed them in the street on the way to the stake. Yet it was said that this good man carried himself as though he was walking to his wedding. Rogers was offered a pardon for his so-called offensive preaching against popery, and for his denial of the doctrine of transubstantiation, if only he would recant. The offer was made, temptingly, when the faggots of kindling were already heaped around him. Nevertheless, he refused. He did not waver. He did not flinch. "That which I have preached will I seal with my blood," was his staunch response to the offer. He was accused of being a heretic. "That shall be known at the last day," came his steady reply. With that, he was consigned to the fury of the flames. Rogers was but the first. Within 4 years, nearly 300 men, women, and children followed in his footsteps and were burned at the stake because they would not bow the knee to Rome. Some authorities give an even higher figure. Who were these martyrs? Historians have not always been fair in their dealings with the men, women, and children who made up this horrendous number, and as a consequence, there is a great deal of misunderstanding about the kind of people involved. The vast majority of those who were done to death were ordinary men and women, not the famous, learned ministers, bishops, and the like. Indeed, it needs to be stated, it is high time that the truth was more commonly acknowledged, that the vast majority, undeniably the overwhelming majority, of those who died for the faith in Mary's reign were Anabaptists, and not members of the Church of England at all. This is not sufficiently well known. Even worse, it is sometimes deliberately forgotten and suppressed. It is important to put the record straight, not only for the sake of the memory of the godly men and women who died, but also for the sake of a proper understanding of this struggle to reform the Church. Rome knew who her real enemy was. That is why so many Anabaptists were killed by the papacy and her agents. It was in places like London, Canterbury, and Norwich where the largest numbers died, all centres of Anabaptism. Men like Thomas Hawkes at Coggeshall, who was burned alive because he would not have his child baptised in the papistical way, ought ever to be remembered with honour. If the apostle exhorted the church concerning Epaphroditus, "Hold such men in esteem, because for the work of Christ he came close to death, not regarding his life," how much more should we not forget the likes of Thomas Hawkes, who did give his life for the faith. Persecution is a vile game. Rome and the reformers have been playing it against the Anabaptists for a long time, and playing it hard. As we have seen right from the early days of the Reformation, even in 1525, Rome and the reformers have been slaughtering Anabaptists, first in Switzerland, then throughout Europe, including England. For example, 14 were burned at the stake on the 4th of June, 1535, in Henry's time, when Cranmer was Henry's archbishop. But it was far worse than that. Henry had huge numbers of Anabaptists put to death throughout his reign. Then Archbishop Cranmer and Bishop Ridley carried on the terror during Edward's time, as they continued to put them to the stake. I've already remarked that it's no excuse to say that some of the Anabaptists held heretical views on the nature of Christ. It's undeniably true that some of them did. But burning is no way to convert a man or woman or child who is mistaken in his view. Even the ignorant spectators at poor Joan Butcher's execution at Smithfield on the 2nd of May 1550 during King Edward's reign knew better than Ridley when they said that it would have been better to send her to Bedlam rather than to put her to the stake. Yet even John Rogers, just spoken of, called the Anabaptists an horrible set of gross and wicked heretics. He approved of Joan Butcher's slaughter, and replied to one who had tackled him about it that burning alive was no cruel death, but easy enough. What a mad statement. How foolish and misguided can good men be? Even Cranmer, a mere few weeks before his own execution, was still blindly prepared to assert that she had been well worthy to be burned. Such facts illustrate the truth that those who believe in the Constantine system know how to wield the physical sword in the supposed advance or defence of Christ's kingdom. And they're not afraid to use it. To put it bluntly, it seems that they just cannot avoid the temptation to pick up the sword. Henry used it, Edward used it, Calvin used it, Luther used it, Zwingli used it. We've looked at Calvin's defence of the barbaric system. It can come as no surprise that under Mary the Church of Rome now made full use of the arguments of the Constantine regime. How can men so easily forget the words of Christ? For all who take the sword will perish by the sword. This is exactly what happened in Mary's time. Former persecutors became the persecuted. Former executioners were executed. Former incendiaries were burned. All the while, the Anabaptists were crushed like a nut between them both. During Mary's reign of terror, the state church condemned victim after victim, following a mockery of a trial, and then handed them over to the state magistrates to carry out the abominable sentence. Of course, Rome never stained her lily-white hands with blood. She never executed anyone. It was the civil authorities who did it. But what hypocrisy! Under the system of Constantine, the church and the state are one. And that was the principle under which both the papists and the reformed churches, including the Church of England, operated. It's not to be puzzled over that reformers and Romanists, both of them, put so many who opposed them to the sword or to the fire. It was a direct and inevitable consequence of the satanic doctrine of Constantine. And no amount of whitewashing or attempts to explain away the whole story and wicked reign of terror will get rid of the stain. Mary continued with her obstinate madness to the very last. Only 2 days before she died, 5 were burned in one fire at Canterbury on the 15th of November, 1558. But by this time the people of England had grown utterly sick and weary of the persecution. Not least in the providence of God, Rome had done harm to her own cause by the wanton shedding of the blood of hundreds of godly men and women. So much so, the people of England breathed a long sigh of relief when Mary died. They'd had more than enough of the stench of burning flesh reeking in their nostrils. Mary had effectively turned the nation against Rome. She had sickened the people. God had seen the oppression of his saints, heard their cry, and knew their sorrows. God had brought the counsel of his enemies to nothing. It was similar to his use of the tyrant Cyrus to further the well-being of the Jews. God used the vindictive and bloodthirsty Mary to advance the cause of his church in England, and God did it for the same reason. As he declared to Cyrus, so the same could be said to Mary, that you may know that I, the Lord, who call you by your name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel my elect, I have even called you by your name. I have named you, though you have not known me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. There is no God besides me. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. In addition, by God's sovereign will, the persecution during Mary's reign furthered his cause in another way. Many of the friends and supporters of the Reformation in England fled the country during her monarchy, very much as Hooper had done during Henry's time, and with similar results. The Marian exiles travelled and settled on the continent, where they met and resided with the reformers. They saw at first hand the form of church life in places like Geneva, Zurich, Strasbourg, and Frankfurt, and they liked what they saw. Typical was John Knox, who had preached on many occasions to King Edward, and with very telling effect. When in exile, Knox eventually settled at Geneva, where he studied under Calvin. As I've shown, what he discovered there so impressed him, it eventually led to the Reformation in Scotland taking the Presbyterian and Calvinistic form. No wonder, considering he thought Geneva was the best school of Christ on earth since the time of the apostles. Although the struggle for the establishment of the New Testament church seemed to go against the godly in England during Mary's reign, the reality is the battle was positively advanced through the fruitful contacts between the exiles and the continental reformers. When these exiles eventually returned to England, as they did in the reign of Elizabeth, they brought with them the doctrines and order which they had learned out of the New Testament through their close first-hand study of the practice of the continental Reformed churches during their enforced stay abroad. This would have consequences of the utmost significance in the battle for the reformation of the church. In Edward's time, Hooper had brought back with him scruples about the wearing of vestments. Vestments? The Marian exiles learned things far more advanced than that. Bigger reforms were needed, and these exiles were anxious to see them come about. Oh, yes, their time abroad was well spent, and the church in England under Elizabeth would reap the benefit. Yet, once again, God had turned his enemies' firepower against themselves. They had, in short, built the work they tried so hard to destroy. The martyrs did not die in vain. All honour to their memory. It is very easy, I know, to say that the church has no need to fear persecution. It has become a cliché to say that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. But it is true all the same. Apathy and indifference are among our great enemies. We ought to fear them. They breed carnal laxity in the church, with its constant decline, decline in spirituality above all. On the other hand, persecution always refines the church and makes her strong and virile. The more the saints are mown down, the more they flourish. In these dark days at the start of the 21st century, we are surrounded by indifference. We are shrouded in apathy. What is worse, the spiritual indifference is not only a marked feature of the world outside. Depressingly, it is only too common to find it inside so many churches. What is more, the world we expect to be carnal and thoughtless about spiritual things, it always is. It cannot be anything else. But the churches, how can they be unconcerned about spiritual life? But many are in that condition. Very many are inwardly apathetic when it comes to spiritual obedience. This must be sorted out as a matter of urgency. The churches must be reformed and reforming, and it might well be that the answer to the many prayers for revival and awakening which are sent up to God in these days will take the form of an outbreak of stern opposition leading to persecution, though it would not be pleasant to state the obvious. In this way the Lord would purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer to the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasant to the Lord, as in the days of old, as in former years. It might even take another Mary, even an Islamic Mary, to bring about real spiritual advance. Perish the thought that we should be so foolish as to need it. But can we not learn? Let us not be stiff-necked and foolhardy. Will we not reform ourselves, and thus avert the need for a torrent of needless affliction? Come what may, the name of the Lord will be magnified, and his church will be purified and reformed. Certainly it is true, the church was not destroyed by papist persecutions under Mary. Far from it. It came out of the onslaught in a much stronger position, at least potentially speaking. It was poised to make a great advance. But would it?